My PhD is in comparative literature, and so I've read literature in many different languages, studied these in the course of my academic training, and I wanted to approach Lewis in a slightly different way than the previous two lectures that we had, which I found to be utterly illuminating, and I thank both of my colleagues for what they did. Although I want to ask how Tolkien, remember the famous letter of Tolkien to his son, how The Lord of the Rings is a fundamentally Catholic work. We need to think about that somehow. And I want to talk about our large subject here is the Christian imagination, which I think Lewis has some very interesting insights about. I think he has very interesting insights about imagination in general, because he too was a literary scholar and wanted to get clear about what the uses of the imagination were and are. And so I'm going to look a little bit at his theory. I deliberately gave this title, The Practice and Theory in Lewis. I'm going to look a little bit at his theory, but there's also a warning about misuses of imaginative work that I want to get to as well, because we all know that when we engage a work like Tolkien or Flannery O'Connor or many, many other writers, they do something to us that's enchanted, the way we've been talking about. They take us out of our normal world into another world, which is an important thing that Lewis thought they need to do. But he also warns that we have to be cautious, even when we are dealing with works of the Christian imagination, that we not take those works to do things that they are not really capable of doing, which is give us answers about philosophy, theology, etc. So let me just start to read this paper, and maybe I'll be disciplined tonight, unlike in the past. In a famous passage, C.S. Lewis revealed how it was that he came to write The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which I'm sure you all know is the first in the Chronicles of Narnia. How many of you read the Chronicles of Narnia? Yeah, I expected as much. How many of you have read the Screwtape Letters? Okay. How about The Great Divorce? That's actually quite a few. How about Till We Have Faces? Good. Well, I hate to tell you, but I'm not going to focus on the ones you've already read. But he at one point, Lewis talked about how he came to write The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the first of the Narnia tales, and he says this. The lion all began with a picture of a fawn carrying an umbrella and parcels in a snowy wood. The picture had been in my mind since I was about 16. Then one day, when I was about 40, I said to myself, let's try to make a story about it. He gave similar accounts, by the way, though the gestation period was not long, about how the space trilogy came to be and some of his other stories as well. And this suggests, I think we ought to take this quite seriously, that his stories were rooted in mental images that just came to him. And a lot of his other imaginative output, I think, reflects a side of Lewis that we maybe neglect, because he used to call himself, you'll remember this if you've read into his work at all, an old Western man. In fact, he used to say, you know, for square-rigged types like myself, all that modern poetry, T.S. Eliot and all those people, you know, that's not for me. But yet it seems that this image came to him out of nowhere when he was 16 years old and infatuated with the northerness and with Wagner and such things. And I sometimes wonder how his hard-drinking, hard-smoking friends of his at Oxford, what they would have thought if Lewis said to them, before he had written any of the Narnia tales, that he'd had this image in his mind of a fawn with an umbrella over his arm, carrying a bunch of parcels in a snowy wood. I think they would have thought, oh, he's one of those guys. He was quite proud. Now, I would say that some of Lewis's best apologetic works, and of course, Lewis has got to be ranked among, probably with Chesterton, as among one of the greatest Christian apologists in the 20th century. But I also think that there's a way that the images that come to his mind just pour out of him. And if you begin to pay attention specifically to the kind of imaginative images he uses when he's making a theological point or a moral point or a more general Christian point, you'll be shocked at how much of that actually appears step by step in his arguments. There's a passage early on, I think it's actually in the introduction to the Screwtape Letters, where he could have used a very simple description, and instead, this is what he says, and I'm quoting, to devastating effect. "I live in the managerial age, in a world of admin. The greatest evil is not now done in those sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint. It is not done even in concentration camps and labor camps. In those, we see its final result. But it is conceived and ordered, moved, seconded, carried, and minuted in clean, carpeted, warmed, and well-lit offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not need to raise their voice. Hence, naturally enough, my symbol for hell is something like the bureaucracy of a police state or the offices of a thoroughly nasty business concern." Sound familiar? Now, our main subject in this entire conference, of course, is the Christian imagination, which is already a vast topic. And Lewis was a prolific writer, wrote a great deal of expository prose and a great deal of imaginative work. So in the brief time we have together, I'm going to focus on just a few specific works that are, I recognize, are a little bit eccentric because of my own personal history. And I want to use them to look at primarily two main subjects, okay? First, how does a specifically Christian imagination manifest itself in Lewis's literary work? As I kind of kidded Professor Koons about, we it's a problem. It's not exactly an irresolvable problem, but if you had to point to something and say, what's the Christian element in Tolkien, it would be a longer conversation than in most of the Lewis works, obviously. Right? He's very explicit in some works. So towards this end, I'm going to draw primarily on partly the Chronicles of Narnia, partly Screwtape, but I do want to go to those lesser works that I mentioned before, The Great Divorce and Till We Have Faces. And by the way, I think Till We Have Faces, talk about the recovery of paganism, I think it's breathtaking. I mean, literally breathtaking, the imaginative working out of that. I've read it many times. I've been enlightened by it every time I read it, but I'm still hoping before I die to get a grip on exactly what it's all about. So first, that. How does Lewis's Christian imagination show itself? And second, not in time. I'm going to be going back and forth with these two things. What did Lewis himself think about the nature of truly imaginative literature? He has a lot to say about it that I find to be more illuminating than most of the things that I studied back in the days when I was working on my own doctorate. And for that part of this presentation, I'm going to use just one book, a little book of his called An Experiment in Criticism. I don't know if any of you have ever read it, in which he tries to kind of reverse the categories of how we judge whether a literary work is good or bad, and I'll get to that in a minute. And An Experiment in Criticism was written in 1961, just 2 years before he died. He died the same day that John F. Kennedy was shot in Dallas, by the way, in November of 1963. So An Experiment in Criticism, which I'm going to just call an experiment for the sake of saving us time, I think is a very rich expression of his mature thought, and I can't recommend enough that you look at that as well if you haven't read it already. So what I want to say to begin with is, if you look at Lewis's own attempts to understand literary imagination, they're very incisive, but they're also very tentative. And they're tentative for a good reason, not only for people who study literature, but for Christians who study literature. And that is, we don't want to too quickly think we understand what is good imaginative writing and what is not. Now, Lewis himself, of course, had, as a professor of literature at Oxford and later at Cambridge, had read widely in works of various kinds, from Homer to D.H. Lawrence, Jane Austen to H.G. Wells, and many others. And he knew it was a tricky thing to evaluate what is good literature and what is not. And so in an experiment, I think he was reacting to, back in the 50s and 60s, there were a lot of efforts to try to come up with objective criteria by which you could say that's good literature and that's bad literature, right? Look, he calls this sort of evaluative criticism. And he says, no, I want to take a different approach to this. So I want to think about what kind of effect does it have on the reader, on the reader's imagination. So when a literary genius who works that magic on us is able to take us into a new space and kind of cast a spell on us, that's when we know something is happening, right? And he says that despite the ups and downs of literary tastes, there are two different ways to read books. One is you read a book, say the way you would read a chemistry textbook. Once you understand the principles, you don't really need to read it again. A great literary work keeps calling us back and back to it. I mean, I don't know how many times I've read Dante, for example, or read Lord of the Rings, or Lewis himself. But that seems to be the touchstone between what is genuinely great imaginative work and what is not. Now, that reverses what we usually think. We usually think, your English professors probably told you, oh, yes, this is very vigorously written, and look how lively the images are. And all that may be true, and as the editor of the Catholic thing, I can tell you that some very well-known writers need an editorial pen, and I have to work on these things sometimes at 6 in the morning and sometimes at 2 in the morning, and there are some definite rules, I think, that make good writing good writing. But what he's talking about is something that each of us experiences. And so he turns, in an experiment, he turns it around. He says, when people keep going back to a book, there's something there. And he said, if I see someone reading a book and he's telling me how wonderful it is, or a woman tells me that she's just entranced by this author, he said, it's sometimes like a friend that you have who has a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a spouse or a husband or wife, and you know, you say about him, I can't understand what he or she sees in him or her. But it makes you look again, right? Because there must be something. You know your friend is not foolish, or maybe he is, but still, there is something there. What is that? What is it that keeps drawing you back? And so, without trying to lay down rules about what's going to be great imaginative literature, he says, there's got to be something like that enchantment that keeps calling us back. And the way that it does is it calls us out of our normal patterns. And I want to look at that very closely in just a minute. Now, so Lewis says, why do we read imaginative literature? So for some of you, this may be a bit of a disappointment. As I said, he says we do not read imaginative literature primarily for philosophical principles or theological principles or Christian solidarity. He talks about, as many others do, and we all have these favorites. He talks about authors that we all love, like Virgil and Dante, but also odd writers like Lucretius, the ancient Epicurean poet, Latin poet, who seemed to fascinate readers, you know, throughout the centuries. And why? How is this possible? What is it? You know, there's a high degree of something that we can't get anywhere else in works like this that we have to try to identify as what really constitutes literary imagination. Now, he warns, if he's warning us as Christians to be careful not to, what he would call, instrumentalize Christian work. So in other words, we don't go to Tolkien and try to find out what it's going to mean to be a Christian hero, or we don't go to Lewis to try to find out what it means to be someone who encounters beings in outer space as a Christian. We go there for a different kind of experience that we then later reflect on. And I think I feel obliged to say this. I don't know where things are at now in literary studies, because my life is taking me off into other directions, but I think we want to be very cautious as readers of literature now about other ways that literature gets instrumentalized. And I particularly worry about what I see in terms of sort of identity politics in the modern world, where you read works basically in terms of race, class, and sex. Now, I want to be clear about this. There can be works written about racial issues, about sexual issues, about class issues, and they can be great works. But if we read them solely the way a Christian might try to read a Christian work, that is, so that the work becomes a kind of a tribal text for us, we're not really appreciating the greatness that literature is able to bring to us, right? There are other ways that we can have solidarity, or we can try to understand social relationships. Literature has got to have its own particular value if it's going to be great literature. Otherwise, we're doing sociology, or we're doing, you know, ethnology, all sorts of different things. What Lewis calls this in an experiment is castle building, that it's kind of an egotistical way to affirm who we are as Christians, or someone else is as a Chinese immigrant to the United States. Literature has a different function than that. And literature can function as a way to express solidarity, to make us understand what life is like for someone, but it's got to go beyond that. I remember when I was doing my PhD studies back in the 80s and reading, it was the heyday of literary theory. I think theory is actually too logical for literary theory these days. I came across a sentence in one great literary theorist. He said, well, you know, if we remove race, class, and gender from literature, what else is there? And I said to myself, I don't know, there's probably a parent's love, a love between spouses, a love of a place, a love that moves the sun and other stars, to quote Dante. There are all sorts of other subjects than these things. And as with the work that Owen Barfield and Tolkien were doing about the way our world has been narrowed by the very language that we use, so that our concepts are not opening us up to others, up to other experiences, to other places, I think that we need to be very cautious about that, even in terms of Christian literature, not only contemporary literature. What Lewis talks about in an experiment is that great literature leads to the enlargement of our being. He says all of us, even the greatest among us, saints, heroes, thinkers, we're all limited. We're individuals. He says, literature, when we really come across great literature, and I'm quoting here, literary experience heals the wound without undermining the privilege of individuality. Let me read that again. Literary experience heals the wound without undermining the privilege of individuality. So it opens up windows, but we are still ourselves. We're still ourselves, but we're more sympathetic, we're more open to other points of view. We have greater experiences through literature. He also says in an experiment that what literature does for us is something that people think is a disadvantage. And I'm quoting here. It's a temporary annihilation of the self. I mean, this is an experience we all have. When you're fascinated, I think we probably all have this experience with Tolkien, with those hundreds and hundreds of pages. Suddenly you wake up hours later and you don't even know where you are. And that tells us something about what's happened to ourselves. We've been taken out of our normal everyday selves. So he adds to this, this is an odd paradox that we've had this temporary annihilation of self. He that loses his life shall save it. And so he adds in an experiment, here as in worship, in love, in moral action, and in knowing, I transcend myself, and I am never more myself than when I do so. He speaks about Dante in particular in this context. Now, for that to happen, we have to have not only writers with that mystifying gift of creative imagination, we as readers need to practice a certain sort of ascetic silence, he says. He says that inner silence, the emptying out of ourselves by which we ought to make room for the total reception of the work. And when we do that right, when both reader and writer are practicing receptivity, that's when this strange literary fascination takes place. It works, something works on us, and we enable ourselves to be worked on. We're not simply like monads bumping into one another. We have a very profound exchange and very profound expansion of our own points of view that we normally wouldn't have. Now, I want to give you a test case. This is not a Christian literary work, but it happens to be the end of a poem that expresses a profound rejection of Christianity. But that ever since I read it, now this is a personal reaction, you may not have the same reaction, but ever since I read it, I understood something that I didn't before. So let me read it to you first. She hears upon that water without sound a voice that cries, "The tomb in Palestine is not the porch of spirits lingering, it is the grave of Jesus where he lay. We live in an old chaos of the sun, our old dependency of day and night, our island solitude, unsponsored, free, of that wide water, inescapable. Deer walk upon our mountains, and the quail whistle about us their spontaneous cries. Sweet berries ripen in the wilderness, and in the isolation of the sky at evening, casual flocks of pigeons make ambiguous undulations as they sink downward to darkness on extended wings." Does anybody know that poem? This is Wallace Stevens' Sunday Morning. It's about a woman who's not going to go to church on Sunday morning. And she says, I still feel a need for some transcendental bliss. And at the very end, she has this kind of vision. And when I first read this, I was an undergraduate. I memorized it instantaneously, and I can still recite it. Obviously, my whole professional life is built doing things that contradict the story told there. But I understood something. I think the order of the words, what Lewis calls in an experiment the poema, the actual making of something, the order of those words is just stunningly beautiful. Now the logos, this is the other term he uses in an experiment, the logos, the meaning of it, is something that of course conflicts with my Christian views. But I understood after reading that what a certain type of atheist might feel. What kind of world? I mean, to me, and probably most of us in this room, if God did not exist, there were not an afterlife, if all those things that have come down to us in the Judeo-Christian tradition were false, the world would look very bleak to us. But I really had an insight reading this of what it would be like for a person who could become content and could enjoy the actual physical beauty of the world that God has created. Now, I don't believe that view, by the way, can survive very long without Christianity. The further and further we get from Christianity Professor Coons was talking about it, we start to get this mechanical, very reductive view of what nature is like. But at least for that moment when someone could try to live a life and see the world as a rich, colorful, mysterious place even without God, that opened up something to me, at least. By the way, on his deathbed, it said that Wallace Stevens converted to Catholicism. We don't know for sure. He was in a Hartford hospital, and the priest who came to see him in the hospital says that he asked him to be baptized. Well, anyway, I hope I've gone through this very quickly, but I hope you get a sense of what Lewis thinks of his proper literary imagination. It's going to expand our souls. It's going to temporarily cancel our more selfish selves and open us up to others so that we understand other points of view. I want to turn to a problem of artistry now, because I come across an awful lot of people who love Christian literature for what I think is the wrong reasons. And I'm no doubt going to be pelted with rotten fruit when I say this, but I like the Narnia tales, but I don't love them. I read them, and I reread some of them before I came here. I read them to my children when they were growing up, and they like them, but don't love them either. I asked them about this the other day, just I was in Dubai with one of my daughters, and I asked her, and she said, they were okay. And I think that the reason is that the artistry is not perfect, that it's not seamless, that in a way there is in Lewis, in a number of those stories, not entirely, and I'm going to contradict myself later and show you some things that I think are quite remarkable. I want to read some passages later. But the making, you know, the perfection that we see almost without without limit in Tolkien, I think we see breakdowns in Lewis where he gets a little bit preachier in the actual stories in ways that kind of stick out. And I'm not saying you can't have an explicitly Catholic or Christian literature, but it doesn't work. It just seems to me in some places that it doesn't work. I'm reminded of that famous remark of Flannery O'Connor in this context. You may remember this. She said, the Catholic novelist doesn't have to be a saint. He doesn't have to even have to be a Catholic. He does, unfortunately, have to be a novelist. But look, we can be moved by imperfect works. I think I love G.K. Chesterton. I think he's one of the most hilarious men who ever lived and a great literary genius. His novels, they're bizarre and they carry you along, and I reread them all the time. But maybe there was another way to do some of the things that he did. Okay, where shall we go now? There are, however, touches in Lewis, and these are the kinds of things I would like to point out to you about his Christian imagination, because he's able to, we know from the Screwtape Letters what a tremendous ear he had for the different social registers in his society, right? He had these toffs who speak in high British English, who are kind of at odds with one another, and then there are people further down the social scale who he sees how sinfulness and virtue play themselves out with them as well, and then on and on and on. But there are these moments when Lewis just transcends, I think, in ways that very few other writers can. For example, I think of the place in one of the very first pages of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And again, we're dealing with the work that this came out of his imagination 24 years earlier when he was 16 years old, right? He's writing this. And I think of the place in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe where Lucy has gone into the world of Narnia, and she meets Mr. Tumnus, who's the faun, who came out of Lewis's imagination, and they talk a bit, and then they go to a cave, and they're having tea, right? And here's what Lewis says. Mr. Tumnus takes up a small flute because they want to relax a little bit. Lewis writes, "The tune he played made Lucy want to cry and laugh and dance and go to sleep at the same time. It must have been hours later when she shook herself." It's a very rare way of imagining something that Lewis is able to do just almost effortlessly in a lot of different places in his work. But what I want to do, instead of looking at that type of work, is I want to look at something specific that I think Lewis does like no one else. And you may want to dispute me about this, but I spent many years studying Dante, and when you study Dante, you have to think about what is it like to portray the afterlife? You know, this is something that Christian literature sometimes attempts to do, very rarely succeeds at. Dante's entire Divine Comedy is about the afterlife, right? He starts in a dark wood and he ends up with the beatific vision. Lewis, in several works, makes this very ambitious and sometimes foolhardy effort to talk about what the afterlife is going to be like. He admits in one of his essays that he spends his spare time imagining landscapes, and he says, I think probably a lot of other people do the same thing. I've got to tell you, I don't do that. Maybe some of you do. But you see in his works how he imagines landscapes in works like Paralandra, where, you know, he's on the planet Venus, and it's mostly water with these floating islands, and it kind of makes you seasick, where people are trying to get from one island to another. He just has this kind of imaginative power to convey landscapes. And it's the one thing that I think in his practice is just utterly singular among modern writers. He's able to try to go and portray what would the next life be like. It's very complicated. It's hard to do. George Orwell once said about the kind of representation that you get in Dante that the Christian heaven looks like a choir practice in a jeweler's shop. Not entirely fair, but yeah, there is some truth to that. In Lewis, what we get is utterly remarkable in that he tries to use the things of this world to suggest something transcendent. Because obviously the next world has got to be transcendent. And he, you know, in his expository work, he says, well, you know, we really can't know that. It's all analogous. We just make these stabs, and so we shouldn't take any of these things literally. But he makes the effort a number of times anyway. And since one of his touchstones for what constitutes true literary imagination is that it kind of helps us transcend ourselves, same way that we transcend ourselves when we love another person, or we go out of our way to help someone in society, or we, you know, there are just a very few ways that human beings are able to transcend themselves. This way that he looks at landscapes, I thought this would be good to bring out, because the other things I think we're rather familiar with. We know the moral arguments, you know, if you've read Screwtape, or even if you've read The Great Divorce, we know the kinds of things that the vices that people hold on to because they don't really want joy. They don't really want the thing that we were made to experience as Christians. So the kind of transcendence that he is able to produce, I think, is magical and almost without compare. And I would say this. He builds all that on a simple principle that others have said, but almost no one has been able to present. And it's that the next life is more real than this life. Some of you may have come across that in his work. It's more real and it's more substantial. Lots of people have talked about that. But I know of no one who's actually been able to represent that idea the way that he does. So let me start with a description that takes place in The Great Divorce. If you remember The Great Divorce, it starts out in this dismal city, which is either hell, if you choose to stay there, or it's purgatory if you choose to leave, to try to go someplace else. And it keeps getting larger and larger. It's like the expanding universe. Because everybody's always fighting with everybody else, and so they move houses. So the city keeps getting bigger and bigger, and so it's like the stars disappearing out into the utter blacknesses of space. Lewis actually says in this book that the whole problem in trying to describe hell is that it's so close to nothing. It's not substantial the way the real world is. The real world of the reality of joy of God himself. So this is where one of the protagonist in The Great Divorce, this is what happens when he gets into this bus, right? And he goes up what he thinks of as this towering, sheer cliff. He rises up to this very green plateau that represents something else other than that dismal city. And here's the description. He says that the people he goes up there with, they're like ghosts, they're like smudges on glass, so you can't see the reality behind the glass. Then some readjustment of the mind or some focusing of my eyes took place, and I saw the whole phenomenon the other way around. The men were as they had always been, as all the men I had known had been, perhaps. It was the light, the grass, the trees that were different, made of some different substance, so much solider than things in our country that men were ghosts by comparison. Moved by a sudden thought, I bent down and tried to pluck a daisy, which was growing at my feet. The stalk wouldn't break. I tried to twist it, but it wouldn't twist. I tugged till the sweat stood out on my forehead, and I had lost most of the skin off my hands. The little flower was hard, not like wood or even like iron, but like diamond. There was a leaf, a young, tender beech leaf lying in the grass beside it. I tried to pick the leaf up. My heart almost cracked with the effort, and I believe I did just raise it, but I had to let it go at once. It was heavier than a sack of coal. I know nowhere in literature where that reality of the other world, it's so impenetrable, so hard for us, so impossible for us even to move in any way, comes through. He goes on, here's another part of the description. I'm going to read you some descriptions now. The light and coolness that drenched me were like those of summer morning. Early morning, a minute or two before the sunrise. Only there was a certain difference. I had the sense of being in a larger space, perhaps even in a larger sort of space than I had ever known before, as if the sky were further off and the extent of the green plain wider than they could be on this little ball of earth. I had gotten out in some sense, which made the solar system itself seem like an indoor affair. It gave me the feeling of freedom, but also of exposure, possibility of danger, which continued to accompany me through all that followed. This, to me, is quite striking. And then even more striking than this, he meets up with, if you've read this, he meets up with a teacher who's going to start to explain to him what's going on in that world. And the teacher, turns out, is the Scottish writer George MacDonald, who had great influence on Lewis and Tolkien and Barfield and others. And MacDonald, without getting theological, tries to explain to him what happens with the souls here. Well, you know, some go back down, some take a while, and they'll go on to the mountains, which is where true joy and true reality exist. And then he explains to them, the character, who's probably Lewis, asks, what about these ghosts, you know, ghosts that are haunting houses? Yeah, he explains, you know, some ghosts can't leave their houses, so they can't leave their spouses, so they haunt them. And then as a writer, I noticed this reading, he says, and some hang around libraries to see if their books are still being read. So the Lewis character says, well, how do they go back down there? I mean, you know, they go down that sheer cliff, that huge area. I mean, does the bus take them down there? And listen to this. This is how George MacDonald begins to describe things. Look, he said. And with the word, he went down on his hands and knees. I did the same. How it hurt my knees. And presently saw that he had plucked a blade of grass, using its thin end as a pointer. He made me see, after I looked very closely, a crack in the soil, so small that I could not have identified it without this aid. I cannot be certain, MacDonald says, that this is the crack he came up through. But through a crack no bigger than that, you certainly came. But, I gasped with a feeling of bewilderment not unlike terror. I saw an infinite abyss and cliffs towering up and up, and then this country on top of the cliffs. But the voyage was not mere locomotion, and that bus and all inside of it were increasing in size. So the Lewis character says, do you mean that hell, all that infinite empty town, is down there in some little crack like this? Yes, all hell is smaller than one pebble of your earthly world. It is smaller than one atom of this world, the real world. It seems big enough when you're in it, sir, he responds. And yet all loneliness, angers, hatreds, envies, and itchings that it contain, if rolled into one single experience and put into the scale against the least moment of the joy that is felt by the least in heaven, would have no weight that could be registered at all. MacDonald says there's only one who could go down into that crack and bring people up from it. It's so tiny compared to the reality of God. And of course, it's Jesus who is able to do that. Well, I say that I'm getting near the end of my time. So I'm going to just recommend some other readings to you. If you haven't reread The Last Battle lately, do so. Because at the end of The Last Battle, you may remember, it's the end of the world, right? Narnia collapses, the very stars fall out of the heavens, and they come into the new world that the children and Aslan are in, and they appear to be living beings. And you think everything is done. Everything turns dark, right? And then all of a sudden, they're in Narnia again. And this Narnia, the children, and the other characters who were in the old Narnia, they finally realize this is the true Narnia. This is the Narnia that we only had a dim glimpse of when we were back in the first Narnia that we were in through all these different stories. And what Lewis does at that point is so amazing. I know no other way to explain it. He's the only person, I think, who's ever tried to talk about the resurrection of the body. He hasn't quite put it this way, right? But you read Dante, you get the beatific vision, you get the choir practice in the jeweler shop. There's more in there than that, I can tell you. You can read my book about this if you don't believe it. You get that, but what about the resurrection of the body? And what about the new heaven and the new earth? And Lewis is just, through some very fresh images, able to convey this. I don't even think it's a subject that other people have attempted. He's able to convey this without it being maudlin, without it being trite, but giving you a sense of something that you always knew was there. And even the Narnians talk about how this is really the Narnia we always wanted to live in, and now it's a reality in front of us. All right, I'm going to read two brief paragraphs from another work that I want you to read, and that's the Till We Have Faces. Till We Have Faces is a retelling of the Psyche and Cupid story, talk about pagans, from Apuleius, who's a second century Neoplatonic pagan who'd been introduced to the ancient mysteries, etc. And Lewis had read this when he was a young man, and he thought it didn't make any sense, the motivation of the characters. And it's set in a pagan kingdom in the Middle East that has only very intermittent contact with Greek civilization, so it's not very sophisticated, but there are palace intrigues and wars and whatnot. But there's the story of Cupid and Psyche, of the marriage of the soul with love, a very, you know, very implicitly a Christian theme. And very Lewis at the end. Psyche tells her sister, who never understood all of this, and complains and says, don't you want to come back to the happiness that we had as children instead of being up there with a god? And this is what she says. This is what she says. You don't understand. Not that kind. I don't want that kind of longing. It was when I was happiest that I longed most. It was on happy days when we were up there on the hills, the three of us, with the wind and the sunshine, where you couldn't see Glom or the palace. Do you remember? The color and the smell, looking at the gray mountain in the distance. And because it was so beautiful, it set me longing, always longing. Somewhere else there must be more of it. Everything seemed to be saying, Psyche, come. But I couldn't, not yet, come. And I didn't know where I was to come to. It almost hurt me. I felt like a bird in a cage when other birds of its kind are flying home. Do you think it meant nothing, all the longing for home? For indeed it now feels not like going, but like going back. The longing to reach the mountain, to find the place where all that beauty came from, my country, the place where I ought to have been born. So I'll leave you with that beauty of Lewis's and what I think are some of the most singular elements in his own Christian literary imagination. And I'll be curious if some of you read this, write me. I'll be curious if these, now that I've pointed them out to you, move you in a different direction in reading him than the usual readings of the Screwtape Letters and some of those other great things. But this is Lewis, as St. Augustine said, discovering beauty, tam antiqua, tam nova, that ancient beauty that we all came out of, that is ever new, and it lies ahead of us someday, if we're lucky, in our Christian lives. So, thank you.
We'll have 10 minutes for Q&A this time, and we will prefer questions from people who have not yet heard this question.
found it increasingly difficult to be present and read, just with all the distractions in our culture. And I'd like to know how you specifically have taken the steps necessary to get to a place where you could be fully patient and present.
Would you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, the question is, it seems to be increasingly difficult to be focused in reading, and you know, what steps have I taken or can one take to be more receptive, to be ready to do that kind of deeper reading. It's obviously a big problem, and it's the screens, as everybody's been saying, it's the screens that make things hard for us because we flip from one thing to another. And I have to say, as a writer, I write every day 1,000 words, and it's very helpful for me to be able to instantaneously look up something and not have to go to the library to get references or, you know, meaning of something. But this is an ascetic discipline that one has to develop. I read a lot on Kindle because I travel a lot, and I can't carry 8 books at a time with me because I'm still writing when I'm traveling too, and that is a real discipline. It's a discipline to look at the text that you're looking at and not go looking at your email or the latest text messages that came in. It's just one that you have to kind of develop. The best thing, I think, though, is every day to read on paper. You know, at least read 15 minutes, a half hour, whatever you can do. Somehow our eyes and brains seem to take in more. This has been documented. They seem to take in more from paper than they do from pixels. I don't know why that should be, but it just seems to be so. Maybe because we have so many associations on the screen with other things. But I don't think there's any one formula for this. I know people who buzz along on their screens and read and are, you know, very deep thinkers and read. But you've got to find out what works for you, I think.
Talking about what makes literature great, sort of, it seems to me that a lot of what's lacking in Christian art is a sort of almost propaganda-like quality that it doesn't really deal with the messiness of life. I was watching a Jordan Peterson lecture where he talks about like the difference between propaganda and like art and literature, which is that the propaganda is too conscious about life, and like art and literature, that there's something that happens to the writer in that experience of writing where they become sort of unconscious and just represent an experience in that. I was wondering what you thought of that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's what I was trying to get at. Look, Narnia is an amazing world. And you know that Lewis basically wrote all the Narnia stories in 1 year, 1953? Once he got going on this, somehow it just all poured out of him, and there are remarkable pages after. But to take specific books, there are places where you start to feel that he's, you know, there is a propagandistic element, or there's a little bit of the too much stiff upper lip for the British child kind of, you know, approach in places. And I think that takes away. He has such great imaginative gifts. I think it's less so in the space trilogy. Outside of the planet, you don't really feel that. Paralandra, you don't really feel it. I know people who are crazy lunatic fans of That Hideous Strength. I am not, because I feel you feel the same. I just tend to feel that it's a little bit. If I want to read that, I'll read The Abolition of Man. Because it doesn't seem imagined well to me. The head, you've got to read it, you've got to make up your own minds about it. But I'm going to be with Lewis on this, that people do love it, and just like, you know, I don't know what he sees in her, some people do see it, and I'd be happy to have them explain it to me if they do see it. But look, the key here, I hope that was clear from his an experiment of criticism, the key is not whether you're making arguments. You know, you could be making an argument about, you know, like the way a certain group has been discriminated against, or you can be making an argument about the Christian view of something. And if artfully done, and if the reading is an engaged reading that opens us up outside of ourselves, Lewis would say, that at least is prima facie evidence that something good is going on. If instead what you're starting to do is saying, yeah, that's me, that's what I think, that supports this political party or that political party, or you know, somebody I know who is arguing with somebody else, then the literature turns into polemics that is not the kind of thing that he's talking about. Literary imagination is going to expand our world. It isn't going to make us more partisan or more tribal or you know, whatever. There are ways in which I suppose literature does that. When you first find your way into Lewis or Tolkien or lots of other authors, you say, wow, I'm not crazy. There are Christians who are very smart who can imagine what a Christian world looks like, right? But it can't stop there. There has to be continuing, I think, maturation of what those visions are. And if you find that you're going back and back to certain books, you're probably experiencing certain things that Lewis says tell us that we've got a classical text. And as I say, a Christian, and I think we ought to be specifically aware of this, can be reading all sorts of literature profitably. You know, there are things that just tell us, they tell us about human nature, they tell us about history, they just expand our own personal experiences in ways that you can't live 100 different lives, right? But you can appreciate, if there's great artistry, you can appreciate someone else's life in a book. Remarkable as that is, or perhaps even in a movie. I think he hasn't asked yet.
Okay.
Well, kind of building on this earlier question, it seems like we do live in a very distracting age. Technology and so forth, as I think you addressed, is certainly distracting us, and it doesn't help. It doesn't help our pursuit of God and of goodness and truth. But I think you've struck at a really important point about literature being something that, as you said before, enlarges our being and is something that calls us out of our pattern. And whenever you're describing it that way, it sounds like literature can almost be something that assists in conversion. And so it sounds like if we're having trouble focusing, if we're having trouble engaging in a text, if we can see it as being part of our conversion, and we can see it as being part of our telos, and we can, and that literature can take us out of and can help us to almost have a change of telos. It becomes teleological, right? Where rather than the world and our lives being about ourselves, we recognize that that our end is something fundamentally different. The world and our lives are instead about our Creator, who gifted us with that life. But and so, in that way, it seems like literature, along with I'm sure a number of things, become a means of conversion, and that therefore can assist and quicken us in our pursuit of God, and we can find and acquire, achieve, and be assisted by all the graces of God in that same pursuit.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, anything that transcends the self these days, when you love another person, that's the most common way that most people transcend themselves. Usually when people begin to mature, they look outside of themselves, and you think that you're losing yourself by looking outside, but you're actually enriching yourself, because no human being it becomes rich alone in a humane sense, right? We all need the interaction with one another, and ultimately the interaction with God, in order to be fully what we're capable of being. So this is going to take a variety of forms, and partly what I think Lewis is after is what we were also seeing in the lecture about Tolkien, is that our language and our world has become so reduced by a kind of a scientific reductionist view of what things are. It's one of the reasons why I want to focus on landscapes and transcendence rather than the interaction with the people that I think we all kind of get when we read those. It's brilliant, but I think we can all apprehend that pretty easily. If our very language these days is restricting what we can think and say and appreciate, well, we need some way out of that prison. I think it's in the on fairy stories that Tolkien himself says, some people say, well, this is, you know, this is turning away from modern reality, and he says, yeah, and it's a good thing, too. The modern reality is, you know, it's not what human beings need to live a full human life, let alone, you know, divine life. So there are many, many different parts of this. One of the things I tried to emphasize here that I hope, you remember nothing else, is that Lewis is encouraging us to look for all those different ways out of the prison of the self, the legitimate ways out of the prison of the self that open us up, maybe initially to one another, maybe to nature, maybe to certain truths, ultimately to God, of course, because ultimately God is the guarantee of all these different forms of transcendence. But there is a funny kind of literary transcendence, you know, where you read an author and you say, wow, you know, I get that, and I've never thought of that before. Or yeah, I have thought of that, but now that I see it in that context, I see how important this thing is. And I think because literature mostly transpires through images and story, it resembles ordinary life more than if you read philosophy or theology. Philosophy and theology are absolutely necessary. Science is absolutely necessary. Technology is absolutely necessary. But literature has its special place. We don't want to conflate it with those other things. We want it to have the magical uses that Lewis both practiced and then also theorized about.
So Dr. Hain brought up the paradox of wanting to leave this world, wanting to die, but also enjoying creation and enjoying the beauty around us. Do you think that the idea, so I'm thinking specifically of the passage from Till We Have Faces, where she's saying, the moments where I would, when I was most happy are the moments that I wanted to transcend. So would you say that that statement of Lewis's was a solution to that paradox? So you only want to leave this world, you only want to die when you truly enjoy the creation around you. So is that paradox sort of?
Yeah, I think the paradox is that it's one that just exists in reality, that we all yearn for in the future what lay at the origin. And so it seems like it's two different directions. One, you would have to be going back to the creation, and one, you'd be going forward to the new heaven and the new earth. But in a sense, you know, they're present in some kind of continuum. So when she's saying that it was the times that I was the most happy, that I longed for the source of that happiness, that she kind of felt she had an intuition or an emotional reaction to something that she knew could be even greater and more transcendent. I didn't get into the passages in The Great Divorce where they go up into the mountains and there's sort of this lightning. If you've read that, it's remarkable. So it's very Dantesque too. It's not orderly. You know, Dante has got his vision, but it's also an orderly view of the different vices and then the different predations and then the spiritual openings in paradise. And Lewis, he's not as Thomistic, so he's kind of moving from one thing in modern life to another. But at the same time, behind this lies this, I keep calling it kind of a landscape. It's a transcendent landscape that people, you're either going to go back into a crack in the ground, or you're going to be open to joys and illuminations that you can't even begin to imagine. And it's frightening, of course.
All right. I want to say thank you so much to all of our attendees, to our student leaders, to our TI liaison, and to our guest lecturers for hosting and having an amazing event.